Boxes were all filled with gifts, big and small. But sharing pure love is the greatest gift of all. Stay cozy, my people, and have a Boss year.
Get into the holiday spirit with Boss and our ultimate gifting edit. Visit your nearest store or explore our curated selection online at boss.com.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
Hi everybody, Dan and Andy here. Just to let you know that our special guest on this week's Fish is none other than Anne Miller. You'll remember Anne because she's been on loads of times before, though she hasn't been on for a little while. We are so excited to see her again. Anne is a brilliant children's author. She's written Mickey and the Animal Spies, a series of children's books all about animals, spying and codes. They're fabulous. And as you're about to hear, she is obviously a magnificent researcher and elf. So we hope you enjoy this episode.
That's right. We also just want to quickly say happy birthday publication to Andrew Hunter Murray, because The Sanctuary, yep, has just been released in paperback. This is such a brilliant book. It's a book that is so brilliant that Waterstones have actually decided to make it the thriller of the month. So you're going to see it everywhere in bookshops. And it's a book that's been called many things by many great people. It's been called imaginative and intriguing. The Sanctuary sucks you in and doesn't let you leave until the very last page by Anthony Horowitz. It's a brilliantly clever thriller by a brilliantly clever author, says Richard Osman. They are all telling the truth.
Oh, Dan, thank you. Yeah, guys, it would mean the absolute world to me if you picked up a copy of The Sanctuary in paperback. It's a gripping, twisty thriller set on a mysterious island off the coast up north, where one of the world's wealthiest, most enigmatic men is building an entirely new society. It's all about that and what the young hero from the city finds when he goes and sees this new world being built. It's about billionaires, it's about mysterious islands, it's about the near future. If you're looking for a gripping summer read on the beach, I think this could be the one for you.
That's right, and it's also brilliant. So do make sure you go and get a copy from our own personal Sunday Times best-selling author here on the show, Andrew Hunter Murray. As I say, available in all good bookshops, both online and in the real world. Do pick it up, help our buddy out to get back in that Sunday Times chart. All right, on with the show.
On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with James Harkin, Andrew Hunter Murray, and Anne Miller. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in a particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Anne.
My fact is that Anne of Green Gables is from the same island as the world's largest potato sculpture.
Welcome back, Anne.
Are you suggesting a link, a causal link between the two?
Between great literature and great snacks.
Oh, that's, yeah. Nice.
It's a large potato, a great snack. I'm not coming around the Oz Super Bowl Sunday.
So, I don't know really who Anne of Green Gables is.
Shall I give you a potted Anne of Green Gables 101?
Yeah.
So, Anne of Green Gables is one of my favourite books of all time. It is set on Prince Edward Island in Canada. I was given it when I was very young, and the setting is just completely beautiful. So, the thing about Anne is she is an orphan. This brother and sister called Matthew and Marilla live at a place called Green Gables, and they are convinced to adopt an orphan boy to help them on the farm. But when they go to collect the boy, it's Anne. She's a chatterbox, she's imaginative, she gets into endless scrapes, but they love her, and she sort of builds this new life on Prince Edward Island. And when I was a little bit older, my godmother sent me a postcard from Green Gables, and it was as if someone had sent me a card from Narnia. I didn't understand how she'd been somewhere that was in a book.
Amazing.
And I remember being so confused. Yeah. And like, it was like, oh, had a nice time at Green Gables. And I was like, how did you get there?
Saw a really big potato. Did she say that as well?
She did not. Oh. She did not. I found out about that more recently. But yeah, so the island, because Lucy Maud Montgomery, who wrote the book, lived there and is set there. There's lots of places in the book is actually there, and it's a sweeping series. There are several books beyond Anne of Green Gables, and I was planning the trip of a lifetime to go and see Prince Edward Island for summer 2020, so I didn't make it there. But while I was reading about Prince Edward Island, I found out that they also are the home of the Canadian Potato Museum. Mm. And outside is a 4.3 meter tall potato. We had a picture taken, and I almost want to go there as much as I want to go to Green Gables. It's got exhibitions, it's got potatoes in tiny coffins to show the different diseases they can have, it's got a potato themed gift shop, it's got a potato themed restaurant, so you can have baked potato with a side of crisps, you can have potato skins, potato soup, and what do you reckon you can have for pudding?
Oh, I know that they make potato fudge there. Yeah.
With mashed
potato fudge.
With mashed potato.
Wow.
I did have a quick look at TripAdvisor for the Potato Museum.
Yeah.
Pretty overwhelmingly good.
Yeah.
I think it's also a tribute to Canadian positivity.
Nice.
And politeness.
But which one have you picked out then?
Oh, you know, obviously I was looking for the negative reviews. Yeah. And actually, there are very few, which is a tribute to the restaurant.
Yeah, but let's hear the one.
There's one three-star review which sniffs that the big potato could have been a little more realistic. The TripAdvisor review does say suggested duration 1 to 2 hours for your visit, which I think by the end of the second hour, you'll be running short of things to do. But you're right, they have absolutely loads of stuff. No, and they say it's a living testament to the humble tuber and those who have tilled the soil in its evolution.
Did they have any 2 or 1 star reviews?
They had so few, actually, that I think it would be unrepresentative of me to read any out. And I didn't write any down because they weren't very amusingly written. But it's clearly a very popular place.
The museum was started by a guy called Dr. Lloyd George Dewar, who was a politician. And I tried to find anything interesting about him, which was really tough. I even went into like these, what they call it, the websites that tell you about your family.
Mm. Oh, like, your ancestry.
Yeah, like an ancestry one. Mm. And I found out that his great grandfather died at the age of 101 in the town of Dull in Perthshire.
No!
The only interesting fact about that.
That's all I could find.
Yeah, that's great.
Amazing. How heavy was this sculpture potato again, by the way?
Oh, they didn't say the weight.
They don't list the weight.
They don't list
just the height.
It's way to deter thieves.
Because I found the world's heaviest potato and was just curious.
How heavy is the difference?
Well, it's going to be a lot less heavy, I assume.
We're saying heaviest real potato.
But is it a real
one? It's a real potato, which was just under 5 kilograms.
Nice.
Is and that all?
I know. Well, this is the thing, because potatoes aren't water-bearing organisms like your squashes. Why the big squashes are kind of a ton and the biggest potato. But it's grown by friend of the podcast, Peter Glazebrook, who we've mentioned several times before, because he's done things like the longest bean the biggest
marrow or whatever.
He's got a load of those records.
He's a UK guy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he is.
Which
he's
is very exciting.
He's
a champion. We should get him into the building sometime.
Unfortunately, he won't fit through the door.
he can carry his bean the other way, you know.
Oh, that's a good point. But what about the 9-foot apple?
I wanted to find a bigger potato to kind of spoil this fact. Because that's my job on this podcast.
That's right.
So I looked at all the other potato museums around the world to see if they had one.
There are surprisingly quite a few.
There are quite a few. But I found in the Idaho Potato Museum, they have the world's largest Pringle.
Ooh.
And we have perhaps a Pringles controversy with this.
A further,
because you weren't here when Sarah Pascoe was on, but she had 5 Pringles controversies.
Yes.
But this is the world's largest Pringle, but it's flat.
Oh.
It's not the shape of a Pringle. So do you call that a Pringle?
But was it made by Pringles?
It was made by Pringles, yeah.
Is it made from the material of Pringle?
It's made from dehydrogenated
potato starch.
It's just not got the shape. That's an interesting. What makes a Pringle? Is it the shape or is it the...
What do you reckon, Anne? Do you reckon it's a Pringle if it's not Pringle shaped?
I think if it's made by Pringles, it's a Pringle.
Do you? What about the box that's made by Pringles?
No.
The box is also a Pringle. It's a cylindrical Pringle.
Very doctrinally.
I'm going to double down on this.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Sadly, I do agree. I think it is a Pringle. If they say it's a... I think they have naming rights. Yeah.
So I can't call it a Pringles controversy.
Ooh.
Oh, well, I think we've certainly argued about it just now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's controversial that you're trying to introduce it as a controversy. Certainly. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I'll email Sarah.
Yeah.
I did find out about the world's another non-largest potato in the world.
Yeah.
And this was, you may well have seen this in your research as well, which was nearly a knockout blow to Peter Glazebrook's 5 kilo potato, which is, I think, about an 8 kilo potato.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was found by a pair of farmers in New Zealand who the Guinness World Records people wrote back to them when they wrote in saying, we've got this. They said, in fact, it's a tuber of a kind of gourd, and DNA testing actually revealed in true Jerry Springer style.
Wow.
It wasn't a potato at all. It was called Doug.
That's great.
After how they got it out of the ground.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah.
Doug.
Samantha Baldwin, who's a researcher at the New Zealand Institute for Food and Plant Research, presumably having a morning off or something. So we tried running multiple tests on samples of Doug, but he just wasn't behaving like a potato should. Because he wasn't a potato.
I like the idea of like vegetable espionage, though, like posing as a potato for many, many years.
I mean, it looks like a potato. And the finders, they made a little trolley to drag it around on. It's quite sweet.
I have a couple more contenders for giant potatoes.
Oh, okay.
So I was a little bit concerned when I was double checking that there was a giant potato in Cyprus, which is 2 foot taller. But sadly, or luckily for me, was chopped down by vandals. So it wasn't me who did it.
Was it just done this week? Yeah. Really? Just after you sent this back?
Yeah.
That sounds suspicious.
You are looking tanned.
Yeah. Yeah, and you look so gleeful at the moment. I mean, no jury would acquit you at the moment.
I can't work out if you're sad or, if you're hysterical with...
I'm very sad. No, sorry, the one in Cyprus was 2 foot taller.
You're
it's
not doing a good impression of someone who hasn't chopped down a giant potato, I'll put it that way.
Well, I definitely didn't chop down the one in Australia. So they have the big things, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course.
And they have the big potato. But theirs is lying down, so it's long. Did someone knock it over? No, but it did for a while have a face, which is sort of mildly terrifying. And the face has been taken away. I'm not sure if it was stolen.
Wow.
Any more for potatoes?
No. How about Prince Edward Island? They
make about 1 million tons of potatoes each year.
They're big, grow.
A quarter of Canada's potatoes, despite it being a very small Canadian province.
Yeah. One of the smallest, I would say.
Yeah.
A lot of the potatoes on Prince Edward Island are grown and processed by McCain. Who are the world's largest manufacturer of frozen potato products. You'll know them from their oven chips.
Yes, big fans.
They were founded by two brothers called Harrison and Wallace McCain. And like, it seems every single company that's founded by two brothers, they got into a massive legal dispute.
No.
And then one of the brothers had to leave and took over a thing called Maple Leaf Foods.
Rivals.
Isn't that amazing?
I thought you were going to say there's a potato... equator around the world, like the Aldi brothers.
But no, isn't that surprising?
That is bizarre.
It does seem this thing that brothers start companies and they fall out.
Was it Adidas?
Adidas and Puma.
Yeah.
And right Twix and left Twix.
Wow, an oasis.
An oasis. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very big island as well. It's 175 miles long.
Oh, did I just say it was a small one?
It's a small province, but it's a big island.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because Canada's massive.
It's big.
I think everyone forgets how big Canada is. Just shout out for Canada there. But did you know we have a lot of listeners on Prince Edward Island?
Really?
So I had a little look in the inbox, the fish inbox, podcast@qi.com. We have had so many messages from people over the years saying, I'm on Prince Edward Island and I would like you to cover it. And here are some facts.
Okay.
So I've got a couple for you.
Right.
Ryan Barrett, who works for the PEI Potato Board.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Thank you.
Big shout out to him.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote an email a couple of years ago. This was when Anna was in charge of the inbox. Ryan, I don't think you got a reply. So I'm here to write that wrong.
Anna really hates Prince Edward Island, doesn't she? Every week she goes on about how much she hates it.
I have to cut it out. He just said some cool place names they've got. They've got an Alaska, a Belfast, a New Zealand, a Toronto, a Norway, a Crapo, which is French for toad, I didn't know, and a Cerise, which is French for mouse.
Oh.
Cool. Yeah. And he also has a fact about Anne of Green Gables, which is that because of Anne of Green Gables, Prince Edward Island gets thousands and thousands of Japanese tourists every year.
Mm.
And that's because the book was the first book taught in English in Japan after the Second World War.
It's
so
massive.
Big cultural influence.
Still to this day, it's ginormous. And they have schools named after it there, the School of Green Gables. They've got the University of Prince Edward Island School of Nursing. And apparently adaptations are just always on TV.
Yeah.
Just non-stop on TV in Japan.
I've always heard that, and I never really understood why. And I read a really cool article by Margaret Atwood to celebrate Anne's 100th birthday. And she said she'd done an event in Japan and she'd asked the audience, and they'd her translator had written down the responses. And one of the big reasons is the author who translated it in Japan was already very beloved, so sort of had an audience there. And there are many things about the book that just really resonated. So Anne was an orphan, and there were sadly a lot of orphans in Japan after the war. She's got a huge passion for apple blossom and cherry blossom, which is very popular in Japan. And the sort of her work ethic, like, she's not scared of hard work and she's very thoughtful, but she's also quite forgetful, but it's because she's daydreaming. She's not lazy. She tries to do her best, and she does wind up in scrapes, but it's never right. She means well.
I did read one place that said that America kind of pushed Anne of Green Gables after the war because they thought it would help, kind of as American liberal propaganda. And they thought that this kind of book, which showed that women were more free thinking, might get them away from some of their old ideas.
Right.
So that was one of the supposedly one of the reasons.
She sounds like a pretty cool character, the author, Lucy Maud Montgomery. When she was a kid, she had two imaginary friends, which is really cool. So she was at her grandparents' house, and they had a bookcase, and it had glass reflection doors on the bookcase, and she could see herself in the reflection. So the one on the left was a reflection of someone that she called Katie Maurice, and the right was Lucy Gray. And it was both her reflections, but she created them as her imaginary friends. Yeah. Very cool idea. And I love that her titles of her books all sound like she's still workshopping the old title. This is Emily of New Moon, Pat of Silver Bush, Kilmeny of the Orchard.
One more to add to that. So there's six in the Anne of series, and then there are two that focus on her children. And the second one is Rilla of Ingleside, which is her youngest daughter. So, spoiler alert, she grows up to get married and has a bunch of children. But what I didn't realise when I was younger is I followed the books through, and you see her grow up. And I hadn't clocked that as she grew up, the year would get so much closer to the war. So it becomes a book about the First World War. So Rilla of Ingleside is about war coming to Canada, which I wasn't expecting. And so two of her children end up fighting in the war. Her daughter Rilla ends up adopting a war baby and looking after him. And it's just very odd to take a character who you know from a beloved children's book and put them in World War One.
I think this about, it's a slightly different example of it, but there is an episode of Frasier where Martin Crane, Frasier's dad, has just watched the Austin Powers film. And it's very weird thinking of them in the same conceptual universe because there's a bit where Martin keeps on saying, "Shagadelic, baby, yeah." And it really takes you out of yourself.
All right.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing that she gave over the trademark, basically, to Anne of Green Gables, to not only her daughters and the heirs, but to Prince Edward Island as well. So they've got the trademark, which means that anyone who works on the island is allowed to make their own sort of products or own merchandise and sell them. Yeah, with no worry of the estate coming at them because they are the estate, which is really great.
How can you do anything? Like,
it sounds like it. I mean, possibly you might have to pitch and say,
You couldn't have Anna Green Gables, for instance.
Oh, yes.
And the Second World War book.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is, in 1952, a cowboy successfully lassoed a plane as it flew past his house.
His house?
Yeah, so he was working at this house. He was working with his boss.
I have a question, Dan.
Yeah.
Successfully lassoed?
Yeah.
Does that mean he got the lasso around the plane and then the plane flew off with his lasso attached?
He tamed it.
He tamed it.
Yeah, yeah. He ended up riding the plane. He broke it, you know, he made it submissive to him.
That's Andy's got it right. The version that's
and the plane lives happily in his garden to this day.
Yeah.
No, this is the basic story is that he was at this house. He was working as a cowboy, and this plane just kept flying really low over the house and kept going by. And you know, they had no idea what was going on. It turns out what was going on was the pilot on the inside was trying to drop a love letter to a girl who lived inside the house, and flying high, he was trying to get her to come out to see the love letter being dropped, right? But this cowboy gets pissed off. So he gets out his lasso. It's a 3.5 meter long lasso.
And as the guy is swooping down, he's flying low. Well, you know, he's got to drop the letter so it lands on a good spot.
Absolutely.
So he throws the lasso at the plane. It manages to collide with the propeller, catches onto it, and snaps off and gets tangled up in the propeller. So the pilot has no choice but to turn around and quickly land the plane. Obviously, the cowboy was knocked onto his back. It was not
obviously
pleasant.
Yeah. And did the guy in the plane survive?
Yeah, he did. And actually, years later, when he was 78 years old, there was a photo of him with the propeller with the lasso rope still wrapped around it. So,
and did he get the girl?
I couldn't find that bit of the
great
story.
Question.
Yeah, great question.
Can I just say, everyone in the story is an idiot.
Is that not the girl?
Yeah. Why isn't she coming out of her house?
How would she know to come out?
There's a plane flying apparently 2 meters above your house. Show some curiosity. Like, she's idiot three on the list. Idiot two, I think, is probably the pilot who's doing this mad. Like, just send the card. Doesn't matter. Idiot one's the cowboy.
Why?
Because he could have killed the pilot and himself.
Yeah. But it's a good point, though. I felt sorry for the pilot because I thought he's trying to do something in secret. Instead, his plane's fallen out of the sky and made a big noise, presumably. But the post is pretty secret.
Yeah, this is not secret. This is less secret, I would say, than the post.
It's not secret. He's not trying to be secret. This is romance. This is, look, you can see me. Hi, I've got a letter. I want to show you my love.
Is it like the 80s thing of turning up outside the house with a boombox?
I was just thinking.
Or the Love Actually thing of turning up with the cards.
It's exactly
and
that.
The propeller card.
Oh, it would be good in Love Actually in that scene if a lasso just came in for the sack.
Or if he's going round to loop the loop with a plane, and every time he does the bottom of the loop, it's another card.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
P.S.
Sorry, forgot to say. Yeah, no, fools.
But anyway, this is a great story. It's a very random story. It appeared in a Time magazine article in a language that is just, it says, like, then a few years ago, some smart fellas bought themselves a little airplane and opened a flying club, just a hoot and a holler from where the ranch cowboy. This is Time magazine. This is how they're reporting the story. So, yeah.
Okay.
50s journalism.
Yeah, his name was Euclides Gutierrez, is how I'm going to pronounce that.
Oh, who's that? That's the cowboy.
That's the cowboy, right. Yeah. It's south, again, so little detail about this story, but it's the South Brazilian cattle ranches. So I don't even think this is an American cowboy.
Oh, I see.
We're talking.
I thought we were in the USA.
That's what I initially thought.
I thought we were in Brazil and ancient Greece from his name.
Just on lassos and lassoing things, I did find someone who lassoed cats.
Oh.
This was a cat lasso artist from the Second World War. She was called Miss Iris Davis. It's a really nice story, actually. So lots of buildings being bombed in the Second World War, lots of rubble, lots of, you know, ruins and things. Also lots of cats, lots of people keeping cats. And she was a volunteer worker for something called the Dumb Friends League, which is...
Friends of cats.
Yeah, exactly. Dumb as in, I think they don't speak, rather than stupid cats. But she went from bombed house to bombed house with a cat lasso, which is a very long pole with the lasso at the end, rescuing cats from the wreckage.
Can I ask, Andy, you know, lots of planes flying very low there, dropping bombs and stuff. Do you think a curious person would get out of the house and look up and go, I wonder what's going on there?
Idiots. No, sorry. She claimed in 1940, November 1940, so I guess the Blitz had been going on for a while, she claimed she had rescued 600 cats from bombed buildings, which
knowing
is a lot.
Cats, it was probably the same one.
Someone who's an unexpected cowboy, Osama bin Laden. Turns out he used to walk around with a Stetson on. His favorite shows were Bonanza and things like Fury. He had his own horse. And he absolutely loved the world of cowboys.
Wow.
There was lots of stories because a biography came out where they said you would see Osama bin Laden walking around with his Stetson on, acting all cowboy.
It's amazing it took that long to find and catch him, given that he was...
There can't be that many people in the Tora Bora caves with a massive Stetson on.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
I don't know what to make of that.
I know, it's odd, isn't it? But there's a lot of... So like Stalin, for example, if we're talking like bad people generally, massive cowboy fan as well. Used to love watching westerns, love John Wayne movies, but also hated John Wayne because of his anti-communism stance, and so actually plotted to have him murdered. He ordered KGB assassins to go and try and kill John Wayne. And Chairman Mao did that as well. Chairman Mao hated John Wayne. The stories of assassination plot from Chairman Mao as well.
Are these all put out by John Wayne's PR? Like,
feels like it, right?
Communist dictators hate him. Find this one weird trick.
No,
wow.
there's a Hollywood writer called Michael Munn. I've read a couple of his books. It's one that he did on John Wayne. He found that the FBI had discovered that there were assassins that were sent to Hollywood to try and kill John Wayne.
Amazing.
Gosh.
Do you know how many people you can fit inside a lasso?
Surely, if you have enough rope.
Well, the Guinness World Record for someone who's done it.
So it has to be spinning.
Oh, yeah. Was it thrown?
So it's like, it's spinning, and he's like, getting
I would say, actually, it's smaller than you think. I'm going to say 20 people gathered in a tight... As in, that'd be very hard, I think, to let's do 20 people standing even standing together.
Okay.
I'm going to say, just going with my imagination here, I'm going to say 200, and I'm going to say that the person was standing on top of a first floor building, like the top of a school, massive lasso, and just managed to get the throw.
A school, specifically a school. Then no other buildings have more than one story, as we know. Yeah.
What I'm thinking maybe is maybe around 240 to 300, and they're all on the same plane, and it gets lassoed.
Yeah.
Very nice.
You actually were right the first time. It's 13 or 14, including the guy handling it.
Oh, so you were so close.
You were so close. So,
so he counts.
It sort of does he count. I think the record is 13.
The rope? Yeah. He jumped in.
I think he's doing this.
If he's in the lasso. Yeah, then that absolutely counts. Yeah.
He's in the centre, and he's lassoing around, and other people are gathering around him as he lassoes.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Does that count as lassoing? Because you don't usually stand, say, like next to the wild horse and lasso yourself into it as well.
They do tricks, don't they, lasso artists? Yeah. And I think this is kind of part of that. As in, they like a skipping rope, you'll kind of lasso around, and then you'll do jumping
in.
You're
going to get letters from the Cowboys. And the skipping people. How dare you associate us with those hacks?
I'll tell you what, if someone flies very close to the top of my house, then I'll look outside for the letters.
Marlboro Man, one of the most famous cowboys.
Smoking Marlboro Man.
Yeah, Bob Norris was the original Marlboro Man, who never smoked cigarettes in his life. He actively was anti it, but he was found because he was in a photo with John Wayne, who used to smoke 7 packs a day. Ooh. And they saw him in that shot and went, hey, that guy looks like he'd be good for our smoking.
Wow. Weirdly, he'd actually been hired by Stalin to kill Wayne. And then the film people got to him in time, the cigarette people.
Yeah. So I was looking at other big animals that you can lasso.
Oh, great.
So, do you know how many lassos it takes to get a crocodile safely?
I would have said one.
I would have said
just
one.
Round the mouth.
I'm going to say three.
Points to Dan Shriver. So apparently, the way they do it is they lasso the top bit of the mouth. Then they do it again with a second lasso. I guess that's the most like scary part. And then they do one around the whole mouth, and then they tape the mouth to be so sure. And then the advice was, if it all goes pear-shaped, run.
I was going to say, that's a lot of detail to get right 3 times round. Yeah. Like, we get the clipper sometimes to go to our gigs at Up the Creek, and whenever the boat comes in, they always have to lasso the boat to the end.
Yeah.
And I always have a bet with whoever I'm standing with, are they going to get it on the first go? Sometimes at the third go, but the thing is, the dock's not going to eat you, whereas a crocodile, that's a fine time.
That's one of the first QI facts I ever learned, was that a crocodile can... What is it? It can bite you with the force of a truck falling off a cliff. But once its mouth is closed, it presents no threat at all because you can hold its mouth shut with your hand.
And a rubber band, even just a rubber band wouldn't be...
I think the scariest job is the person who takes the tape off at the end of the procedure. I think that's the real hero.
Yeah. And by that point, it's quite annoyed, probably.
Exactly, yeah.
Have you ever held a crocodile?
No,
me either. But my wife has.
I thought we were on the brink of an Amazing Jane story.
Yeah, we went to the Everglades, and there was a baby crocodile that you could hold called Snappy.
Of course.
And Paulina held it, and I didn't have the guts to hold it.
How big was Snappy?
Yeah. How big were we talking?
I would say, about 1.5 feet.
Okay.
Something like that.
Wow.
That's amazing.
I also did once played mini golf in a place that had crocodiles sort of roaming around.
There's that one golf course where the lake literally has giant snapping crocodiles, which is amazing.
You just have to stay away from them, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, we're in London now.
We are.
Right?
Yeah. No crocodiles.
No crocodiles. But some cowboys quite near here, there is a secret cowboy town in the middle of Kent. Have you heard of it?
Really?
Yeah. Why? It's called Laredo. It was founded in 1971.
What?
And they've got a blacksmith, they've got an undertaker, a tobacconist. It's
like a working, these are early models.
It's life size and it's kind of functional. So it was founded by a bloke called John Truder, who was a pig farmer, and he just loved the Wild West. And he just wanted to recreate the Wild West in his corner of Kent. Uh-huh. It's members only. And they go there at weekends and they recreate life in the Old West.
Cool.
Yeah, you can get a 30-minute train from London and arrive in Laredo.
And they won't let you in.
They won't let you in. No, no.
There's like a random Wild West in Morningside in Edinburgh. Like, it's just, you go like, yes, you go like through an archway and it's just a Wild West, like behind a bank and some really? Flats. Yeah, it's just there.
Oh, I read about it. It was created by a furniture shop, which for some reason, they just, it's called the Great American Indoors, the shop.
But it,
and they made their own.
Yeah, it's not advertised. So everyone would say, have you seen the Wild West? And you'd be like, no, we're in Scotland. And they'd say, oh, it's just over there. And you'd go and look.
That's so weird. That's, and that one you good. Can just walk into.
It's just like behind some flats, yeah.
So does the piano player always stop whenever someone...
No, but there's like always these planes coming down with ropes. It's very strange.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that one of the best ways to trick puffins to a new nesting ground is with mirrors, because they like to be in groups and can't tell the difference between a puffin and the reflection of a puffin.
So they fail the mirror test. They don't know that they are...
Yeah, the mirror test is a thing with animals that some animals, if you show them a reflection of themselves and put a little mark on their head, they'll realize that it's them and they'll try and wipe it off.
Yeah.
Whereas most animals won't do that. They won't see... They'll see a mirror image of themselves and think it's another animal.
Mm.
And in fact, humans... my daughter only did it... few weeks ago, and she's what, 14 months. Wow. So it's until that age is the first time you get to do that, so babies don't know it either. But this is all about a guy called Stephen Kress, and he was working about trying to get puffins into a new area. In fact, they'd been in that area before, but he wanted to get them back into that area on the east coast of America. And one of the ways that he did that was by making these decoys. You can make actual decoys of little puffins, but one good way of doing it is mirrors, because you can get multiple puffins.
Oh, yeah, hall of mirrors, like kaleidoscope stuff.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they saw someone that were really tall, someone that were really fat.
Yeah.
It's this mission he was on, because Stephen Kress, it sounds like a great guy. He's been working on this for about 30 years, 40 years?
Since 1969.
It's a long career in puffinology. And he and his colleagues, they went to a breeding colony which was healthy in... Newfoundland, or just Canada, and they basically had to kidnap loads of baby puffins.
Yeah, the start of the story is a bit dodgy, isn't it?
It's a real villain to hero arc, I think, he and his colleagues went on, because they start off as puffin kidnappers.
The start, people are just like, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
Stealing all those puffins.
They shove them in soup cans, which I like, to transport them all the way to their new home. And then, but then there's the twist, the character twist, where he and his colleagues became puffin nannies, looking after them, breeding them up on this new island in Maine, and they put them in these fake burrows which they had dug.
Right.
And they fed them, they left fish in there, and he constructed all these decoy puffins. And then the thing is that the puffins go to sea eventually when they become kind of teenagers. They gain their independence, they go off, and then he waited for years hoping they would come back to the island.
Because the question is, would they go back to Newfoundland where their kind of genes say that they should be living, or will they remember where they lived as babies and then come back to that place? And in the end
they came back, but I think only in the third year. It was a few years before they did, and he was getting really worried, and then eventually he built loads of decoys and that kind of lured them back.
Okay, that's very cool.
I was reading about puffins' Ministry of Silly Walks. So when they want to show that they're not any, because they live quite close together, they live in burrows. And so if you want to cross across, you'll probably cross lots of other territories, and if you don't want to start a fight, they do this like, hey, don't mind me walk, where they lower their head and they sort of walk quite quickly and try not to get noticed. But if they're on guard duty, they'll stand outside their burrow nice and tall, and they'll sort of stamp their feet like an exaggerated like guard doing a march.
Wow.
I just really like the idea of like, I'm on patrol and don't mind me, just over here.
That's great.
That's really funny.
And they take over rabbit burrows as well. I love that they don't even need to just dig their own burrows. They can
make their own burrows if they want to. And actually sometimes rabbits take their burrows. There's a whole little ecosystem going on there.
That's pretty cool.
I went to the Isle of May a few years ago, which is off the east coast of Scotland, and they've got tons and tons of seabirds, loads of puffins, and there's certain bits where like you cannot stray off the path because the island is just covered in puffin burrows, so you've got to walk on the bits that they know are safe, which is really cool.
Back to Stephen Kress very quickly. He had a big problem with gulls. Seagulls would attack the puffins because seagulls had been living in this area long before the puffins came back. So he tried a few different things. He attracted terns, which are like bigger than puffins but smaller than gulls, and they'll kind of attack the gulls to stop them from coming in there. And he also had a thing called a death sandwich, which is where his arc of being the evil puffin thief and then the nice puffin nurse, then at the end he becomes the gull killer, because he puts these death sandwiches, which is some bread with something called starlicide in. And starlicide is a chemical which is really toxic to starlings and seagulls, but not toxic to any other animals.
Right.
He would put those out, which would kill the seagulls.
Oh my god, where's his arc sitting now? I'm really confused.
It's good.
If we were doing a fact about gulls, it's not good.
No. Exactly, no. But we're not. We're doing a fact about puffins.
My fact this week is that the evil gull killer, Stephen Crest.
And there are still, I think there are still puffineers, as they call themselves, who have to go to the island to keep it you know, healthy for the puffins and you know, prevent the gulls from taking root there. And they, you know, they have to smash up their nests, and they also, I love this, they have a robot mannequin which is dressed in a yellow coat and an Arnold Schwarzenegger mask, right? And they inflate that. I know, it sounds terrifying. And they inflate that to try and scare off the gulls. It's a scarecrow, basically.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But the only problem is the gulls will eventually realise this is a motionless, it's not an effective, scary thing, because it just sits there, it doesn't do anything. So sometimes what the puffineers will have to do is they will have to dress up, they have to put on the yellow coat and the mask, and then go around shooting gulls on the island to prove that it's a dangerous thing.
So the gulls realise
what they're doing.
I just can't help thinking, what if Arnold Schwarzenegger books a nice relaxing break to look at some puffins?
Islands off the coast of Maine, lovely.
Jesus.
I know.
That's bad.
But that's what it takes to, you know, get puffins up and running again. I'm all for it.
I think there's a lot of, like, grey areas in looking after puffins, because I was reading about there's some numbers are declining, very sadly, and there's some concerns that perhaps it's the food they're eating, they're not getting the right fish, the fish are getting smaller. And there's one study where to do this, they would put up a massive net to catch a puffin, then take all its fish off them to examine the fish.
Oh.
It doesn't say whether they gave the fish back.
Right. Their fishing is amazing, because often they will have sort of depleted the area that's closest to an island where they're fishing, and so they have to go on these huge journeys in order to get the fish to bring back for their starving kids who eat like 4 or 5 times a day. And I watched this footage, it's amazing. It was a David Attenborough, Planet Earth. They fly 50 kilometers out to sea. Wow. 50 kilometers. There's a whole group of them that just go in one go. They dive down into the ocean, and they have an amazing swimming ability. They can swim for up to a minute holding their breath, and they use their wings like we would use our arms if we were doing front crawl. As they make their way, they can go 40 meters deep. They come back up when they've caught a fish. It's just one fish in most cases in this footage. They fly them back 50 kilometers again. God. And then when they get there, very similar to the gulls.
All the kids don't want to eat it.
No, they were
No, I had fish yesterday.
There are birds which are called optic skuas who are waiting for them as they come back, knackered, and they swoop down and they steal the fish off them. It's an amazing shot in this Planet Earth documentary, because suddenly one of them gets back because a guy wearing an Arnold Schwarzenegger mask is suddenly shooting. No, that doesn't happen. But 100 kilometer round trip, and then the skuas come for one fish.
Are the skuas, they're sort of famously pirate birds, aren't they?
Exactly.
Don't they, I think I might be making this up, but they squeeze other birds to make them vomit up whatever they've just eaten.
Oh.
And then eat
someone
that.
They're does definitely
that
villains.
Sure, that might be skuas, yeah.
Yeah, there is a bird that does that. Yeah.
The thing with skuas, well, you pronounce them skuas.
Yeah.
Skuas.
Skuas.
The puffins can carry more than one fish because they have skuas on their tongue. Don't they? They have spiky bits on their tongue that they can attach one fish onto each spike and then go down for another one.
But if they get attacked, that's a skewers crisis, you know?
Brilliant.
Oh, lovely.
Thank you.
But part of the reason they're so good at swimming is their bones are denser than other birds. They find it easy to swim, but they can find it harder to fly. So did you read about these puffin patrols they have in Iceland? These are definitely good guys, not a grey area for these ones. So basically when the little pufflings, the baby ones, they use the moon to navigate, but the streetlights can throw them off, so they sort of crash land in the town. And so the whole town is basically united to like save these pufflings. They go out on patrol, they try and find them, and if you find a puffling, like, you have to look after it. So they'll like take them to the cliff, and then they either will pot it down so it can like trot along and catch the breeze, or you just lob it into the air and hope it takes flight.
Lob it into the air
because they need to get the momentum to get up.
If it's sprained, but you're catching it if it doesn't, right?
No, it's going off a cliff.
What if it's sprained its wing?
Hopefully you check that on the way in.
I don't know. I don't think these guys sound like an uncomplicatedly benevolent force. Why don't they turn their streetlights off? That's what a real good guy would do.
I feel like the terminal velocity of a puffin wouldn't be fast enough that they would die. I think they might be all right because they're quite small, aren't they? And
they're really tiny.
If it's the babies as well, then they'll have a really low terminal velocity.
Maybe.
You can survive. Like, didn't Gordon Ramsay fall off a cliff when he was looking for puffins?
Well, the thing about Gordon Ramsay is his terminal velocity is famously low, isn't
it? Yeah. 85 feet, I think it was, he fell off
a
cliff.
I imagine when he falls, he's got like lots of flapping skin on his body and that crabs. Kind of, yeah.
Turns into one of those gliding parachuters.
Flying fox.
Yeah.
Why did Gordon Ramsay fall off a cliff? He was looking for puffins.
Do you know what? This is a story just in the back of my head. I'm going to connect it to puffins. He was doing a documentary and he was looking at Various Island. Yeah. He was on the side of a cliff and they were filming him and he
fell 80 feet.
Disappeared. Yeah, and he fell down and he survived. Yeah.
I don't believe that.
It's true.
Is it?
Yeah.
I think Gordon Ramsay is an honourable guy. I don't see why he would lie.
Presumably it's on film.
I think they never released
They accidentally turned off the film before he fell 80 feet and survived.
85.
What's that? 25 meters? Survivable. It must have been a big patch of heather he landed on. Or whatever it was.
It's a big pile of other TV chefs previously fallen down there.
Bounced off of Worrell Thompson. Fortunately for him. There's a thing which a lot of people say about puffins, which is that they're monogamous. You know, they have the same partner every year, and that's very nice. Well, it turns out, I think it is actually true, because a load of birds, it's not true.
Yeah,
and they study EPCs, extra pair copulations. That's the. Do you remember? Yeah. I think we've mentioned this once or twice before, but they did a study of Atlantic puffins looking at extra pair parentage, because now we've got DNA tests, we can actually sample species, and they are basically monogamous. They are
good for them.
Yeah. I know. So you know. No grey areas there.
Nice, no simple. Jerry Springer in the...
No yeah, Jerry Springer. Every DNA test comes back. Yep, it's all fine. You are the father. Great news.
Yeah. My current favourite puffin fact is that there is scientists creating sunglasses for puffins.
Okay.
Oh,
because, I don't know how this happened, but they had a puffin and they realised that its beak lit up under UV light.
Okay.
But the puffin was no longer alive. So they're not completely sure if it's some sort of the way it decomposes or whether all puffins do this. So to test it, they need to get some alive puffins and shine UV on them. But that could hurt their eyes. So they got to design little sunglasses to amuse themselves. They've made them aviators.
Okay, cool.
That's brilliant.
What did they find? Really?
I believe still pending. Find a puffin, give it the sunglasses, shine the light, and then report back.
Because their beaks do change a lot, right? There's an outer beak that falls off. The color changes at different seasons.
Their beak falls off in winter. And it leaves them with what I found described in one article as a drab gray pecker.
My old Tinder profile. That's amazing.
I know. Young puffins are just completely grey.
Yeah.
They sound so boring.
Yeah.
Just grey all the way through. Grey beak, grey everything.
I always thought that was your favourite fact of all time.
It was one of my very, very first facts I ever found for QI.
Which one?
That a baby puffin is called a puffling.
Yeah.
But now, puffins, I don't know if you noticed, they are on everything. Puffins are everywhere now. So many kids' books about pufflings. And someone I know who works in publishing used to keep a list of like which animals were like on trend. So you will have noticed it, maybe without realizing. So for a while, it was sloths. They were on everything. It was flamingos for a while. Llamas used to have a phase where they were on everything. I think puffins.
Is it like children's books? Do you
just mean? Like also in like in Paper Chase or like on clothing? If you just notice it,
meerkats were massive.
Certain animals seem to like have their moment, and I'm not quite sure why or how, but they do.
But it's never the disgusting toad worm, is it? It's never
he could be spring 2024, Andy.
Never the penis worm, is it?
Yes. And do you feel slightly responsible for that? Because I think you're partly responsible for disseminating the adorable puffling fact.
Because that fact has come out of various different QI iterations.
I did put it
in
a lot of things.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm thrilled. There's tons of puffling stuff out there and they're super cute. So.
Yeah.
You used to get enormous flocks of puffins, didn't you? Mm-hmm. In the UK as well.
Really?
So
really?
The island of St Kilda, this was two people called Herter and Dunn in 1897. And they said that the puffins are in such numbers that clouds of birds sweep past us and make a sound like a whirlwind. And another one said that it made a great cloud that perceptibly interfered with the light of day. And that parasites fell off the birds as they swarmed over us, much to our discomfort and annoyance.
Oh, great,
so you can imagine there's like millions of these birds just blocking out the sun and flying over you and dropping their ticks on you and stuff.
Yeah.
It's been incredible.
Very cool.
In St Kilda, there was one man who caught 620 puffins in a single day.
Lassoed them?
Yeah, using a noose. I've no rod.
No way.
Yeah.
Sorry to jump in on you there.
No,
I didn't expect
that's
it was going
right.
to be that. Wow.
Yeah, pretty much a lasso. That's what they used to use, like these sort of like fishing rods, but with a bit of rope on the end.
That's what this cat lady was using in the Second World War.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
That's very
cool. It's amazing.
There are some places where the puffins are eaten, aren't there?
Iceland.
Yeah, Faroe Islands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say I've eaten them in Iceland?
Have you?
Have you?
Yeah. What did it taste
swine.
Like?
Swine.
It was a long time ago.
Oh, it was the 80s. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Not that long ago.
What did it taste like?
Just to me, I thought it just tasted fish, like fishy, oily, not chicken, but like...
More like fish than like meat.
Quaily kind of stuff. Like gamey, fishy, chicken.
It's a grey area, eating these puffins.
Why is that a grey area?
No, I guess everything we're saying about the puffins is sort of like, you know, you've got to kill them to save them.
As they're being, they're much more endangered than they used to be.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have
back
to,
in the day, certainly back in the day when I was eating puffin that one time, they were all over them. You couldn't move in Reykjavik.
You were on St Kilda, weren't you? And the skies were thick with them. You were actually doing the world a favour. Yeah, yeah.
I was so hoping that when you were grasping for what they tasted like, you were going to be like, a bit like panda, slightly, got that kakapo taste to them.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, lots of places eat, people eat meat, and people eat the meats that are close to them.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
but if a particular meat is endangered, then you change. Yeah,
exactly.
Change
there was customs. Whale on the menu, which I didn't eat.
Wow.
So does that help my arc at all?
Exhilarated, yeah. Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andy.
My fact is that trash talk works better on darts players than shot putters.
Call that a fact.
There you go. It begins. I should have known when I picked this fact. Idiot.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
so,
it's just a study of trash talk,
basically. Why would that be true?
Well, this comes from a piece in The Economist, and it's all about sledging and which is cricket based trash talk and you know sporting insults basically you dish out to people you're in a competition against, and it found that it's there have been studies conducted which have found that trash talk is especially effective at distracting players if you're in a sport that needs fine motor skills or creativity rather than brute strength exhibitions.
Okay.
So sports where you need to concentrate are much more vulnerable, which is why maybe cricket is vulnerable to
chess.
Lots of trash talk. Chess, you don't see a lot of smack talk in chess. Yeah. But you do.
Yeah.
You get loads in. I mean, it's weird because lots of sports have different tolerances of it. You know, so cricket has loads of it. Boxing has loads of it, although
you shouldn't
need to do any trash talk because you're trying to hit someone hard anyway.
No, it's psychological. The whole thing is a psychological warfare, right?
And it's a very skillful sport, boxing, I would say.
Is it?
Yeah.
I just thought you'd batter the other bloke, don't
well,
you?
Well, that's one way of doing it. But if you're a really good boxer, it's all about
is this movement. Why my boxing career didn't soar like a puffin?
Thudded like a giant potato.
Yeah. Oh no.
That's a really good point. In chess, I guess there is a lot of psychological stuff goes on, but it's not necessarily.
It's not normally
your shit.
You suck. Yeah, your shit.
Yeah. In basketball, it's a big thing, and I grew up watching basketball, so you would always see it happening. It's amazing when you see it happening, trash talking between the sort of top players in the league. So
are they better at it?
No, they're sort of. It's just interesting watching them because they're all on mic, right? Basically,
are they?
No, you can hear through the mics of the studio. It comes through, you know.
Okay. So they hear them saying like, "Oh,
yeah, exactly." You hear things. So like, Shaquille O'Neal was up against. So Shaquille O'Neal, one of the all-time greats of basketball, against Kobe Bryant, who was also one of the other, and he was overheard saying, "Kobe, tell me how my ass tastes," as he was about to dunk on him. Right? Like they say,
what does that mean?
He dunk on him.
Dunk on
that's
him.
Disgusting.
Dunking is when you put your bring the ball into the ring and you hold the ring. Kind
why
of
is
thing.
He tasting his ass when he does that?
Because he's going so high that the face of Kobe would be
crumbs.
And then there's this thing in basketball where then you make someone taste your ass after scored a point.
Every day's a school day.
In off the rim. Sorry.
One thing they did with this. With this research you're talking about is they sat people at computers and you had to move a slider to a particular spot and see how many you could do in 2 minutes. And as you did it, a little message would come up on your screen, supposedly from one of the other people doing the experiment, and it would either say, "I'm smarter and faster than you," or "Let's see what happens."
Hi, friend.
And they found actually that people who got the negative messages performed better overall in that one.
That's the thing.
I was reading this because it could spur you on. Like, you think I'm going to lose? Well, I'll just show you.
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. And that's what seemed to have happened in that one. But then they tried it in a task which was slightly more skill creative based, and they found that people did worse, and they were more likely to cheat.
Oh yeah,
because it turns it dirty. So you're like, well,
yeah.
I think one of them might have been the study by Karen McDermott, who was looking into this from the University of Connecticut, and that involved people playing Mario Kart. And before the game, some of the people were insulted with various things like "grab a straw because you suck."
Brilliant.
And so on. Yeah, and I think she had to pick quite carefully, because a lot of insults might be either, you know, homophobic or racist or sexist or whatever. So she had to pick a carefully delineated selection of insults which were cruel enough to sting, "grab a straw because you suck" being one of them, and the insulted players perform worse.
Right.
And they also rated themselves higher as having experienced anger and shame.
Oh no.
Yeah.
But were they playing Rainbow Road?
If you're playing Rainbow Road, you always experience deep shame and frustration and rage. Yeah. But does it make you play better or worse? There seem to be slightly conflicting studies on whether it improves the game
ones.
Or not. Yeah.
And that's similar to what you were saying. I also read, which I just thought was a lovely point, that in a university study, you've got a university ethics code. So what you can sledge someone with is kind of very different to what you can have, like, a whole stadium chanting at you in a basketball game.
I also like the weird social side of trash talking as well within professional sports, which is, let's say, a younger player trying to trash talk and create a relationship of conflict, which would then be on the cameras, and it's a way of social climbing. So like Michael Jordan, for example, would never trash talk whenever he was having it talked to him by like a rookie from a new team, because he thinks, I'll let my game do the talking, and I don't want, I will make you famous by trash talking with you,
it's not worth
it. I think it's worth us saying off menu are shit.
Chris and Rosie Ramsey.
Oh, wankers.
Parenting hell. Fuck you.
There's no point saying, you know, John's podcast about nothing.
John's podcast about nothing is good, James. I stand by. I've been listening. I get all my facts from John's podcast about nothing.
Shout out to John.
Hello, John.
one of my favourite sledges that I read was not so much a sledge, but as an AFL player called Stevie Baker. And apparently during a game, he leaned over to someone and said, "Have you got a sausage dog?" So,
brilliant.
And they spent the next 20 minutes just being like, what? And they couldn't play. It was the worst insult they'd heard.
Okay,
it turned out
that
Baker has a sausage dog. He was just like...
just making chat.
Yeah.
Just
like... This guy was like, he couldn't focus on the game. He's like, what's he saying?
It baffled me. Like, I've heard the phrase sausage dog before. I know what that is, but because it was at a sporting match, I was thinking of a hot dog.
Yeah.
And we're like, what's a sausage dog? A hot dog is a sausage. What are you talking about?
This is where I should swoop in and outfact you, but
it's all about distraction, isn't it, really, at the end of the day.
It just
reminds me, this isn't a fact, but do you ever watch that episode of Cheers when there was like a basketball player and he couldn't miss and he was amazing and he was winning the whole season, and then he went to the bar and started talking about trivia with two of the bar flies, Norm and whoever else it was, and they asked him how many rivets there were in the basketball stadium, and he just, all he could think about the rest of his career was counting these rivets, and all he would do was walk around counting them. He just couldn't play anymore because he was so distracted.
That happened to me in an exam once. I was in an exam, and people would always write on these, like, rickety old desk, you only told them at exam time, and they all say, like, you know, I heart so and so, all that maths is rubbish. And I was sitting at one.
You went to school in an episode of The Beano, didn't you?
I grew up in Dundee,
so you did.
But I was sitting in my seat doing my exam, and on my desk someone had written, there were 32 black lines on the ceiling. And so I look up and there are black lines really close together. Never seen them before. So of course I had to count them, and I lost count. So I'd start again.
Wow. Yeah. Do you think that might have been written by a crafty teacher trying to smoke out easily distracted children?
I think it was one person in your class wrote it on all the other desks apart from their own. I mean, they would be top of the class.
Yeah, good waiting. Yeah. Good. I'd forgotten that until now, but I remember trying to count them.
How did your exam... You'll have still passed, I guess.
Probably very badly. I don't remember.
That's so funny. Yeah. I was looking because you talked about darts and shot putting, some trash talking in those sports.
Oh, yeah.
And of course... We can't not talk about Gary Anderson and Wesley Harms.
Of course we can't.
The amazing match when Harms, who lost 10-2, did an interview and said there was a fragrant smell that came from his opponent. And he said, it'll take me two nights to lose the smell from my nose.
Wow.
And he claimed that Gary Anderson had been farting throughout the match to put him off. And then... Obviously, they interview the loser first and then they interview the winner, and they interviewed Gary Anderson and said, why were you farting the whole time? And he said, there was definitely a smell, but it was 1,010% not me. It was definitely the other guy. And Anderson said, you can put your finger up my ass. There'll be no smell there.
What? What?
What is it with these sportsmen?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I believe the first guy, because that's a very high percentage, so...
That... Do we have trash talk at QI?
No.
What do you mean?
Really, do we?
What do you mean?
I just... Well, so there was a study of Fortune 500 companies, and, like, can you remember people being slagged off in that kind of gamesmanship way in the office? Mm. 61% of employees found they could remember trash talk within the last few months.
Yeah.
And I don't think we do sledging here, really.
I've got 9 years worth of...
Oh,
and unfortunately for you guys, it's on record.
Cue the clip.
Yeah. Is this podcast a whole HR exercise?
One day you guys are going to be called into an office, yeah.
One place where you get smack talk famously is wrestling.
Yeah.
And I was reading a book. It's called Everything to Play For, the QI Book of Sport by James Harkin and Anna Tashinsky.
Oh, my goodness.
Sounds rubbish. Sounds.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't come out until October, so I don't know if it's rubbish or not. Right, but right. I suspect the big names, I expect it'll be quite good.
Give it a fair hearing, yeah. Yeah.
But they argue in that book that the earliest depictions of wrestling that we have, which are in the Egyptian tombs, they're quite similar to today's pro wrestling. Mm. So there's an argument that it could be that all the games were fixed because they were often shown as being one person from Egypt clearly and one person from a place that isn't Egypt clearly, and the Egyptian one always won.
Yeah.
And perhaps it was that they were fixed fights so that the pharaoh would know that his people were the greatest in the whole world.
So you're saying ancient Egyptian pro wrestling is fake?
That's what I'm saying. That's what James Harkin and Anna Tashinsky are saying in their book, Everything to Play For, the QI Book of Sport, in October. But the other thing is that there's a really early one and there is some writing next to it. And it's an Egyptian who defeated a Nubian opponent. And he says, woe to you, O Nubian enemy. I will make you take a hopeless fall in the presence of the pharaoh. And so that's basically the smack talk from 3,200 years ago.
Tell me the flavor that you find in mine ass.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @Schreiberland, James.
@James Harkin.
Andy.
@AndrewHunterM.
And Anne.
@Miller_Anne.
Yep, or you can go to our group account, which is @NoSuchThing. And you can also get in contact with us via our email, podcast@qi.com, and also go to our website. Check out all of the previous episodes. They are up there, nosuchthingasafish.com. And otherwise, come back next week. We're going to have another guest. Thanks for coming back, and so
Thanks
good to see
me.
You again. And we'll see you then. Goodbye.